It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later this hour, I'll talk with spoken word artist Dalek Brathwaite. He's from Los Angeles, but he's been spending nearly 2 weeks in Iowa working with students and adults in Des Moines and Cedar Rapids. But first, photographer, writer, and gardener David Cavagnero long ago stopped taking the food he eats for granted. He is a lifetime, or he is lifetime member number one of Seed Savers Exchange in Decorah and spent many years maintaining the preservation garden there. Recently, his fascination with the food we grow inspired a remarkable journey around the world to find out where that food comes from. He'll present Where Our Food Comes From on Sunday, March 13th at the Iowa City Public Library as part of Project Green's 2016 Garden Forum, and he is here with me now. Hello.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today.
My pleasure.
Now, I want to start with your path to becoming a seed saver, because it's a very interesting journey. You got interested in photography early on and then made your way into entomology. What led you to seeds?
Well, as a matter of fact, I love to sort of jokingly but truthfully tell people that I got involved in gardening and eventually into the wonderful genetic diversity of our food supply directly through the stomach, because my maternal grandmother was the matriarch of good food in our family, and she taught my father and my uncle how to cook, and they taught all the rest of us down the line about good food. So I grew up around home gardens and good food. So the gardening part came naturally to me from a very early age. But it wasn't really until I started traveling around the world myself through my interest in natural history that I began to encounter so many fascinating varieties of fruits and vegetables in other countries, and wanted to grow as many of those back in California in my gardens as I possibly could. And so I was a little bit pre-adapted for my eventual connection with the Seed Savers Exchange.
Absolutely. And tell me how that connection was made.
An interesting story, actually. There was a man in New England named John Whiffy. This is back in the 1970s. John Whiffy was an elderly man who had spent much of his life interested in and collecting the heirloom bean varieties that had been grown since pioneer times in the New England states. He had about 300 varieties of beans that he was trying to maintain. Well, like all seeds, they have to be grown periodically and renewed, and he was getting old and was having trouble doing all of this. So an organic gardening article was published about him and asked for volunteers to help him renew his collection. Well, I signed on right away. I was interested in finding some good additional bean varieties, dry beans and so forth, for my garden in California, and so I started renewing seeds for him. Shortly thereafter, he ended up retiring anyway and gave his whole collection to this little fledgling organization called Seed Savers Exchange, which was only about 4 years old at that time, still located down in Missouri. And so I just continued renewing seeds for them. And when they offered a lifetime membership, I was the first one to join in that capacity. And then finally, in 1984 or so, maybe, they moved to Decorah, back near where Diane Whaley, co-founder Diane Whaley, came from, Protovin, Iowa, and settled in Decorah and planted their first garden, their first preservation garden with seeds that had been sent to them on some rented ground in 1985. National Gardening magazine sent me out to photograph that garden, and I was just like a kid in a candy store. They had 1,500 varieties from all over the world, and I took pictures for an article and volunteered to come out the following summer to manage the garden for them. We fell in love with Decorah, went home, put our farm on the market, moved here in 1987, and never looked back.
Now, your love of gardening and your love of photography found a very nice nexus with Seed Savers and with the work that you were doing. Did the photography take over for you?
It began, actually, back in California in my early natural history days of scientific expeditions. It really began with my being the youngest member of the Galapagos International Scientific Project in 1964. I was I turned 21 in the Galapagos doing the fourth insect survey, including Darwin, actually, of the Galapagos. And when I got back, those pictures were in demand because that expedition kind of was a major event on the map, so to speak. So my career, as it turned out, this hobby in photography, which gradually became a career of its own volition, began really with that natural history work, and then eventually my beginning to teach nature photography and other travels. So all of my early work in California was really nature photography. Meanwhile, I had this huge garden project in California that I started, 150 fruit trees and 45 kinds of grapes and all these wonderful beans and other vegetables. And it never occurred to me to take pictures in the garden. I just didn't occur to me there was even a field called horticultural photography, because I didn't read gardening books and didn't subscribe to garden magazines and wasn't paying any attention until I came to Decora and got involved in the Seed Savers Exchange. And this, relative to the talk I'm going to give on Sunday, it was really my first 8 years at Seed Savers growing 15,000 vegetable varieties from all over the world that just turned me into a food history aficionado. I mean, I was just so impressed with the diversity. So really, my photos helped put Seed Savers on the map, and Seed Savers really put me on the map as a horticultural photographer. So for the next 20 years, I took garden pictures.
Now, I want to talk about the talk that you're giving on Sunday and the project that has led up to this talk, because when I read through the Seed Savers catalog, which I really enjoy doing, a lot of the seeds come with stories about, who was saving them and where they come from. But you were inspired to go farther than that, along with another wonderful writer and explorer, really, Gary Nabhan. Tell me how this project came about. Describe it for me.
I will. Gary, first of all, and I'll get back to him in a moment. I first met Gary because Kent and Diane Whaley, co-founders of Seed Savers, invited Gary, who also was a founder of a seed-saving nonprofit down in the Southwest called Native Seed Search, and had been working very much with Native American people, especially in the desert regions of the Southwest. They invited him, along with myself, to be on the board of directors of Seed Savers in those early days. So I've been a friend of Gary for a long, long time. But back to the Seed Savers collection for a moment, it's very apparent, or was very apparent to me right from the start, that so many of the heirloom vegetables that we were growing that came to us with those stories that you describe, family stories, most of these varieties were brought here to America by immigrants. Well, what were these crops that they brought? Well, more often than not, they were crops like tomatoes, peppers, squash, beans. Well, they came here from Europe. They came with stories and immigrants from Europe. The interesting thing is, of course, that all those crops I just mentioned didn't originate in Europe. They originated in the New World in the first place. And so I became really interested in the journeys that seeds have taken. These crops that were native to South, Central America, Mexico, and eventually came up into North America among the Native Americans, the Three Sisters, beans, corn, and squash, for instance. They went to Europe, probably first with the Chinese, who explored the Americas before Columbus. I don't know if anybody realizes that, but the Chinese circumnavigated the Americas in the early 1400s, well before Columbus, and probably took varieties back to China then. And meanwhile, Columbus and the Spaniards took varieties back to Europe. Virtually all the heirlooms that we know today, the common heirloom tomatoes you see in these catalogs and that Seed Savers offers, they were really developed by farmers and backyard gardeners in Europe during the time between Columbus and the Pilgrims.
So they made their way from the New World back to the Old World and then to the New World again?
And back again in a very, very different form than they went there, because after all, a few hundred years of selection and hybridizing and mutations in people's gardens created all these amazing tomatoes and peppers over in the Old World. And then more recently, to fast forward to a more recent period of history, when the Berlin Wall fell and the Soviet Union, the former Soviet Union, opened up, we discovered that in Russia, the tomatoes had taken a different turn. And all of these now famous so-called black and brown tomatoes that we have in the marketplace, they were developed in Russia during that period, in the Soviet republics. And then they finally made it back to the New World after the Soviet Union fell and the Eastern Bloc opened up.
So in reading the stories of seeds and the people who brought them to the United States, what made you want to go farther and tell the other half of that story?
I think I've always been fascinated by history, and I hadn't thought much about the history of food until I really started renewing all these seeds at Seed Savers. And there were some amazing epiphanies. I'm part Italian, and you all probably know that garlic and Italian cuisine are almost synonymous. So I grew up assuming that garlic was native to Italy. Well, garlic didn't come from Italy at all. John Swenson, one of our members in Chicago, did a major expedition to the heartland of garlic during those early days of Seed Savers in the 1980s. And it turns out that garlic comes from the dry mountains of the stans, Kazakhstan, Tajikistan, you know, the mountains of Central Asia. And the best garlic varieties we have in commerce now, all of which are there, almost all of which are there because of Seed Savers, and the work that John did bringing them, come from Georgia and Ukraine and, you know, the Russian provinces. It had nothing to do with Italy. So I became just fascinated by these stories, and then Gary, to answer.
And you know what? We'll pick up that story right there in just a moment. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in a moment. I'm talking to David Cavagnaro. He'll be in Iowa City on Sunday presenting Where Our Food Comes From, part of Project Green's 2016 Garden Forum. And we'll find out more about Where Our Food Comes From in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up later this hour, I'll talk with spoken word artist Dalek Brathwaite. He is spending 2 weeks in Iowa working with students and adults in Cedar Rapids and Des Moines. Right now, my guest is photographer, writer, and gardener David Cavagnaro. He has been affiliated with Seed Savers in Decorah and spent about 8 years managing their preservation garden there. But he's also published many books and many photographs and traveled around the world. And David, we were just talking about your affiliation with Gary Nabhan. And this, of course, relates to the presentation you'll be giving on Sunday at the Iowa City Public Library, Where Our Food Comes From. And you were just about to tell us, Gary Nabhan, of course, is a nature writer, food and farming activist, an ethnobotanist. And tell me about this partnership and the journey it inspired.
Gary has been interested in the history of food, being an ethnobotanist, of course, for very many years, starting with his involvement with the foods of the Native Americans of northern Mexico and the Sonora Desert region of the Southwest. He became very interested in the story of the famous Russian plant explorer Vavilov, who traveled around the world in the early 1900s collecting vegetable seeds and studying the agriculture of the world, actually the founder of a now famous seed bank called the Vavilov Institute. And Vavilov took copious notes at that time about what agriculture was like, and he collected all these varieties to start this seed bank. But he is most especially credited with coming up with the notion of what we call centers of origin. In other words, in order to find out the history of our food crops, where they actually originated and when, He came up with the notion that if you look for a place in the world where the greatest number of indigenous varieties of a food crop exist, the greatest variety of types, and also where there are ancestral types of that crop, that's likely to be the center of origin. And so Gary wanted to retrace Vavilov's journey, actually, to these centers of origin, and primarily to find out what had happened to agriculture in the meantime. Had the traditional varieties survived? Had agribusiness wiped a lot of them out? What were the cultural changes that may have gone on since Vavilov made this famous these famous journeys? And by the way, just an aside quick on Vavilov, he's especially known because the Vavilov Institute was part of the great siege of Leningrad during the war. And the scientists who were locked up in the seed bank protecting the seeds, many of them starved to death rather than eat the precious genetic resource of the seeds that they were guarding, which is a pretty famous story. At any rate, I traveled with Gary on this book, which bears the title of my talk, Where Our Food Comes From. And I traveled to one part of it anyway, to Ethiopia, which is the center of origin of wheats and barleys. And then we also went to Siwa Oasis out in the Sahara Desert to study an ancient Berber agriculture in the oasis there. So that was the connection I had with that project.
Well, let's talk about that trip to Ethiopia. What I understand it's the origin of wheats and barleys, but what are you looking for? Things have changed a lot since it was the origin.
Yes, the real point I think that Gary was interested in making, and I should back up and say that another one of his projects that may explain this is a book that he wrote called Renewing America's Food Traditions. And he is maybe the first popular author to really make the connection, which is ought to be obvious if we stop and think about it, between food and culture. That is to say that the survival of all of these wonderful, diverse vegetable varieties and fruit varieties we have is entirely dependent on the culture that supports them. We have this genetic diversity because of the different food traditions of cultures around the world. Well, now, as we all know, we are moving more and more toward a global economy, which has decimated the genetic diversity of the world. Whereas we used to have 3,000 commercial apple varieties in the United States, count how many you can find in a supermarket today. You could count them on one hand. And that's been true of all the crops around the world. The ancient rice varieties, the ancient wheat varieties have disappeared. And if we're lucky, they're being stored in some seed bank for genetic purposes, but that's not the same as growing them in situ out in the field. So Gary wanted to know what changes had taken place. Well, let's talk about Ethiopia. Fortunately, from the standpoint of genetic preservation, we found going to Ethiopia during the harvest season that the vast majority of the wheat and barley crop grown in Ethiopia is still grown by small farmers on small plots of land, harvested by hand, not even with scythe, with sickles, and winnowed naturally with the wind and sold finally in the marketplaces. So that may sound patently inefficient, but from a genetic preservation standpoint, it's really, really good news because these farmers are still maintaining the vast majority of genetic diversity that existed. And keep in mind that Ethiopia had a major famine not so long ago because of the drought. Well, part of the reason was that agribusiness had talked the Ethiopian government into promoting a lot of corn growing, which is patently ridiculous in an arid environment like Ethiopia. And when corn took over from the native crops, like their native grain called teff, and when it took over from their native grains, and then a drought came, well, the people starved because they had lost their drought-hardy varieties. But fortunately, a lot of that has come back, and we saw good genetic diversity still in practice.
So in making this journey and in trying to understand those early crops, What kind of information can you take away from that? You can learn a little bit about our past, but why is it relevant to those of us in Iowa today?
I'll turn to another book that Gary wrote, his most recent book, and I'm not going to exactly remember the title. It's a book devoted to climate change, to agriculture and climate change. The climates around the world, as all of us are, I hope, acutely aware, are changing dramatically. They're becoming more erratic. Droughts are becoming more severe. Floods are becoming more severe. Storms are more severe, et cetera, et cetera. This is directly impacting agriculture. So if we have nothing left let's say the corn varieties that we're growing here in the Midwest, which are now grown all over the world, if that's all we have as a major source of grain crop in the world, what kind of resources are we going to have to combat climate change? Because there's no genes in Iowa corn to combat drought. And so the relevance is that if we don't have a diverse agriculture, if we don't maintain the genetic diversity, and not just frozen up in a seed bank somewhere, but I mean if we don't have farmers who actually know how to grow diverse crops, we're not going to have the food resiliency that we need to have a viable global food supply. That's why it's relevant.
Were you, when you traveled to Ethiopia, did you have an opportunity to talk to people there who are working with these original seeds and trying to preserve these crops?
Yes. As a matter of fact, we were very, very fortunate in Addis Ababa. We went to the Ethiopian branch of the Vavilov Institute, and there are folks associated with that institute and with some of the government agencies, in fact, who are doing really, really amazing work in Ethiopia. As in many places in the world, they have obstacles in their way because other aspects of the government that's been promoting agribusiness and modern agriculture, which in many cases is oblivious to these issues, they have all of that to combat as well. But they're doing some wonderful work in Ethiopia, and we were really, really honored to spend time with them. And those people are written up. In fact, my photos of them are in that book, Where Our Food Comes From. So it's a book worth looking up if you want to really understand the history of the world's food.
I'm talking with David Cavagnaro. He's going to be in Iowa City on Sunday talking with people at the Iowa City Public Library about where our food comes from. And he's not talking about where the food on the supermarket shelves comes from, but where the crops that we grow came from originally. And now you also traveled to Egypt?
Yes, and that was a parallel story. Vavilov himself didn't go to Siwa Oasis, but Gary had been to Siwa before. Siwa is an oasis out in the Sahara. Alexander the Great went there to consult with a famous oracle in Siwa during his era. So Siwa has been around a long time. It's an ancient Berber agriculture called waffle gardening. The gardens are sort of sunken gardens with an elaborate irrigation system that's evolved to deal with the varying degrees of salinity in desert springs, which are paramount in Siwa. And so Gary had been there before, and a scientist named Forbes had been there and done similar work to Vavilov's in the 1900s. So Gary wanted to follow his work while we were in the neighborhood and see what happened there. There, in contrast to Ethiopia, I would say the changes have been greater, and they were instigated by one single factor when a road was built to Siwa. It used to be that the agricultural exports, mostly dates and olives and some other vegetables, were taken across the desert by donkey to Cairo and Alexandria, for instance. Now it's all done by truck on a road. Well, the truck similarly brings in all of the modern agricultural products from the Nile Valley, and that is gradually wiping out, out-competing and wiping out the indigenous agriculture. So that's the story that's more common around the world. We're losing culture, we're losing indigenous genetic diversity and locally adapted varieties, and We're going to pay a big price for that one day.
Now, in the United States, of course, settlers and immigrants came to the United States from everywhere in the world. And as you know, through all of your work with Seed Savers, many of those immigrants brought those seeds with them in their pockets and in their suitcases to try to grow something that they were familiar with, that they knew about. And all of these crops came and they became part of our culture here in the United States. When you look at now, I know you were talking about how there's been a homogenization of food that we eat, but I know that there's also been some pushback against that in recent years. So when you look at this incredible variety of foods from all over the world that became part of the American diet, why do you think it's important that we take a few minutes and think about where those things come from?
That's a really wonderful question, and you're quite right. The optimistic part of this story is that whereas, you know, decades ago when Seed Savers first started looking at the commercial seed industry, for instance, and was alarmed at the incredible loss of genetic diversity as agribusiness and hybrids and now eventually GMOs began to take over the marketplace, but since then, and I would credit Seed Savers with a good deal of this, the movement that began around sounding the alarm over genetic erosion, if you will, and then encouraging and promoting some of these old varieties to get back into commerce and to encourage people to grow them in their gardens and encourage the Greenbelt farmers to grow them as well. This has had an enormous impact. And furthermore, the immigrant varieties that are still coming in, think of all the Southeast Asian varieties that came in again with the boat people after the Vietnam War, the immigrants, the refugees that came to this country and brought even more of the wonderful Asian variety. So increasingly now, this interest in diversified cuisines and cultural influences in our food supply has had a profound reverse effect, a restorative effect on agriculture, especially in green belts around urban areas. And this is very, very encouraging.
Now, you mentioned all of these cuisines from around the world. A lot of people say that we don't have such a thing as an American cuisine. Do you think that one is developing?
Well, I kind of hope not. The so-called American cuisines, and there are some sort of labeled that way, they really are an amalgam if you look at them. They're a potpourri of influences from around the world, and that's wonderful. And food is an evolving thing, after all. It isn't static, and that's the good thing about it. But on the other hand, if we don't preserve some of these cultural traditions, and if everything becomes too uniform, we're going to continue to jeopardize the genetic diversity of our food supply. So I would suggest that, you know, every time we eat in an ethnic restaurant, every time we buy organic food, we're voting with our dollar to preserve not only good quality crops and good quality agriculture, but also genetic diversity, which is so important. So we can all have a great impact on this important issue by the way we purchase our food.
Now, for people who read Gary Nabhan's book, Where Our Food Comes From, or who come to your talk on Sunday and learn about our connections and with Ethiopia and with Egypt and other places around the world, what do you want us to take away from that in our daily lives?
I think the most important thing to remember is, I think, just to repeat what I said, that the most important vote that we have for the health of our agriculture and our planet is how we purchase food. This is really a very, very important impact that we can have. The more diverse our diet, the more healthful our agriculture that we support with our dollar, the better we're going to have a viable food supply in the future. So I really would hope people get excited about diversity, get excited about food again, realize that we have this fantastic wealth of variety in our food system that comes to us, by the way, through the work of thousands of years of backyard farmers and gardeners who have who've taken care of as stewards of these wonderful varieties and brought them to us.
Is there a seed that you would just love to chase down the origins of that you haven't been able to yet?
That's a dangerous question to ask me. I have probably 2,000 vegetable varieties in my seed collection. I grow over 200 of them every year. In fact, I'm maintaining 200 kinds of tomatoes myself in my own collection because I'm addicted to all
wow.
this wonderful. So, if I were to say I want one more, I would just reveal how much of an addict I actually am.
Well, David, thank you so much for talking with me today.
You're sure welcome. It's been my pleasure.
Photographer, writer, and gardener David Cavagnaro. He's going to be at the Iowa City Public Library on Sunday, March 13th. His presentation is called Where Our Food Comes From. It's part of Project Green's 2016 Garden Forum. This is Talk of Iowa.